Okay, well, we're working in the book of Genesis. Last week we started talking about Abraham. We're in chapter 12. We talked a lot about different, kind of an overview of Abraham's life, and now we get into some of the details. And the first thing that we encountered, which is kind of the last thing we talked about last week, was the promise that God gave to Abraham, at least the first one that's recorded. There are actually seven different interactions, I guess I'll say, that God had, or at least that are recorded in Scripture for us, that God had with Abraham, and each one representing a promise that God made. And what's interesting is that we don't see a whole lot of conditions on those promises. And that's important for us to know. And as we'll find out, of course, one of our objectives is to look at the Old Testament in the light or through the eyes of the New Testament. Because that way we don't have any trouble figuring out what the significance is of the different passages that we cover if we see what the New Testament writers have said about those passages. So that keeps us safe from speculating too much. But we'll find that a lot is said about the very fact that the promises given to Abraham were unconditional. The faith that was demonstrated by Abraham was a faith that just did what God said to do in a few key events. As we're going to read today, Abraham's overall lifestyle had some flaws to it. Some things that he were not exactly impressive, and things that we wouldn't say today are representative of a person who is a great, holy man that we all would want to go and worship at his feet. No, that's not, we're going to find that that's not what Abraham was. Abraham was a guy to whom God said, I want you to go somewhere, and he went there. And that was so unique in the Old Testament scene, especially at the time when he was alive, that was considered great faith. Really not too dissimilar to today. God is not asking us for to move mountains, not asking us to somehow rise up to become great and shining examples of everything that is pious and everything that is sweet. That would be nice. But most of us aren't able to do that very well. In fact, all of us are not able to do that very well. Scripture says all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Well, we're going to find that Abraham is used. It's because of that fact that all of us are basically rather weak that God uses the example of Abraham quite extensively. Okay, well, that's just a little bit of a preview. I want to look at this promise again that God makes and just refresh ourselves. It's in verse 1 of chapter 12. Now the Lord said to Abram, remember his name's not Abraham yet, it's just Abram. God will later change his name to Abraham, and we'll talk about that when the time comes. The Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I'll make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. I think it's interesting that God puts such a high premium here, not just on blessing Abraham. You notice that? He doesn't just say, I'm going to bless you and everything's going to be great. But he goes further. And this was important, and apparently important, certainly important to God, and apparently important to Abraham as well. Because it wasn't that he was just going to bless him and make him a great nation, but he also says that you will be a blessing. You notice that? It says you will be a blessing. That's important. In fact, actually for all of us. And the fact is, especially through the eyes of the New Testament, we understand that it's, you know, being blessed is not necessarily all that it's cracked up to be if we consider blessing being blessed by having prosperity. Prosperity is overrated. Being a blessing to someone else has a lot more substance to it and a lot more significance. And God is pointing that out even to Abraham here back in, you know, this is probably, if you want to know when this was taking place, it probably was around 2000 B.C. And that's a long time ago. So you shall be a blessing. And look, he goes further. He says, and I will bless those who bless you. Not only would he be a blessing, in just by somehow being able to minister in some way, and we'll see some things that Abraham did. He had a large household that apparently he was taking care of. But those who would bless Abraham and Abraham's descendants would also be smiled on by God. And we see evidence of that throughout the Old Testament. That was one of the foundations to the attitude of Corrie Ten Boom's father. And how many of you know of Corrie Ten Boom? Okay, about half the people here. A great book that I highly recommend. It's called The Hiding Place. I think it's called The Hiding Place, right? Yeah. The Hiding Place, written by Corrie Ten Boom. It's a story of her family in the Netherlands who, as Christians, felt compelled by God to help the Jews out who were fleeing the Nazi kind of persecution. And so, and Corrie, they ended up going to, actually I think she went to Ravensbrück, or I think it was Ravensbrück. The whole family was taken captive ultimately, and she was the only one who survived, and went on to just be a tremendous blessing to the body of believers in the stories that she would tell and the faith that she demonstrated. Just a real terrific story. Highly recommend it. Good for your children to have read. And in fact, actually, you can visit. The Hiding Place was a place in their house that they had built. It was a false wall. Behind it was a place that the Jews could hide when anybody would come to their house. And so you can visit that today. It's in a place called Harlem. That's not in northern Manhattan. Harlem is a town spelled with two A's. West of Amsterdam. So if you're ever in the Netherlands, visit Harlem. You'll find it much better than even the Anne Frank's house. But anyway, the fact is, one of the foundations for their whole attitude was this, that they needed to take care of God's people. The descendants of Abraham were God's people, and they felt it their responsibility to minister to God's people. And in so doing, he says, I will bless those who bless you. It's interesting, the second half of that, and the one who curses you, I will curse. If you look at Jewish history, because Abraham was the beginning, right, of what is what would soon be called the Hebrews. In fact, Abraham was the first one called the Hebrew, Abraham the Hebrew. We have that here in just a couple chapters. Those who have gone against Israel have paid a price. Historically, there's a lot of rubble throughout the historical annals when you trace the history of those who have been abusive to the people of Israel. It certainly was true before Christ, and after Christ, it has continued. So it's very interesting. But what's also fascinating is the Hebrew word that's used here for the one who curses you is the word to belittle. those who belittle you, those who who treat you as nothing, treat you as a lightweight, is specifically the one who, when he said, translates as curse you. Well, actually, mine has my text has a little reference note. Let's see, they say revile, and that's kind of that doesn't quite capture it either. It really means to belittle, and that's fascinating to me. Those who to treat as a little thing, God's people would end up encountering the wrath of God, and that's a wrath that one does not want to encounter. He goes on, he says, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now, it's interesting to me when you stop and think about this promise, and these are real fundamental. And if I were a Jew today, and I were asking myself, okay, has this promise to Abraham be fulfilled? It would be very difficult to handle this very last sentence. In you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. You say, well, wait, I mean, in what way? I mean, all the other things, yeah, I can, you know, point to historical events. But if I'm a Jew, and let me add something there, and I'm a Jew who rejects Jesus Christ, then it's pretty difficult to say, where have the Jews been a source of blessing for the families of the earth? Well, you know, it's kind of hard to say. Although you might say, well, it's the Judeo-Christian ethic and all this. Well, okay, maybe there's something there, but that's the Christian part is the part that is especially spread throughout the world. Judaism, okay, has been here and there, and it has spread, but it hasn't been the kind of wildfire spread that Christianity had. Well, clearly, what he's talking about here is the coming of Jesus Christ that would break down the barriers between the Jew and Gentile, and would make the presence of God through the Holy Spirit available to every person in any walk of life, and has indeed spread throughout this world into the most remote areas of the earth. So it's fantastic. I mean, the fact is, this has already been in the process of being fulfilled. It's there, and it's real. And if you exclude Jesus as a descendant of Abraham, you exclude his impact on the world, then you don't have a fulfillment of this. It doesn't work. So it's kind of interesting how ignored that has been by the Jews, and yet it is clearly the coming of Jesus Christ that would, through the lineage of Abraham, that God would use to bless all of us here, having come from so many different walks of life. And of course, spread, as I said, throughout the world. Okay, so there's that initial promise. There's at least the concepts in it, and he's going to get a little bit more detailed as we go. So Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Remember, Lot was his nephew, his brother. Apparently, his older brother had died. And he was took custody of this nephew. Now, I don't know, you know, I mean, Abraham's 75 here. I mean, the nephew could have been, you know, 60 years old. Who knows how old he was. But they still just kind of stayed together. So they left Haran. And they took all their possessions, or Haran is the pronunciation, and they went down the land of Canaan. And we showed a map last time. So they're down in Canaan. And Canaan, they're right pretty much in the center of Israel. The Lord appears now again. In verse 7, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him, to his descendants. That land would be there. And of course, that is the center of the controversy. Again, just an aside, the promise was to Abraham. Well, Abraham's going to see, as we are going to have, two kids. And one of them's name is Ishmael, and the other one's name is Isaac. And Ishmael is the founder. He's the ancestor of the Arabs. And Isaac is the forefather of the Jews. And the Arabs and the Jews both believe that they have the right to the claims afforded by this promise. And so you can see how deeply rooted that whole conflict is over there in the Middle East. I mean, it's, you know, 4,000 years ago, a promise is made to Abram, and now people are still fighting about it. You know, this is really amazing. But of course, God had other things in mind, and it was, as he clarifies, as we find out later on in this book, God made it very clear that the promise was to Isaac. It wasn't that Ishmael was an illegitimate son. He was indeed born to Abram, but it was by Abraham's action, and it was to his handmaiden was the mother, and it was not a real nice situation, but and therefore it wasn't the promise that he wasn't the recipient of the promise that God had made. As an aside, God did promise. I mean, you say, well, boy, Ishmael didn't have anything to do with that. I mean, good grief, he didn't ask to be born, and why is he being penalized? Well, he isn't. God had actually given a promise also to Ishmael. And he said, look, I'm going to make you and his mother Hagar. He says, I'm going to make you guys are going to be a great nation also. It's going to be okay. It's just that you're not going to have the land of Canaan. And there's plenty of other lands over there. I mean, there's a lot of emotion tied to the whole situation. Okay, well, anyway, so they proceeded. He built an altar, and then he proceeded from there to the mountain on the east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord, and he called upon the name of the Lord. So what do we see here? We see Abram consistently trying to interact with God. And he builds these altars, and when he built an altar, he would make a sacrifice on that altar, and it would be to God, to the one true God. The rest of the people, see, that's significant when we understand what was going on in that whole area. We're going to see him go down to Egypt here in a couple of verses. Egypt was a powerhouse at that time. They were somewhere around the 12th dynasty or so. The pyramids were already built. Egypt was one of the great powers. To the east, and that was of course to the south. Now to the east, the Babylonian kind of area had lots of different very sophisticated cities. Very sophisticated. You know, we sometimes think of this stuff as prehistoric. You know, I mean, it's just kind of barbaric. But some of the digs, and especially in the last century and early part of this century, there was a lot of excavation, a lot of archaeological excavation that is just kind of historical now. It's in, you know, the things that they found are distributed to somewhat obscure museums throughout the world, and people don't talk about it much. But the fact is that they found, there were several libraries, I was reading about them just yesterday, a couple libraries that they had dug up, one of them in right around Ur, where Abraham had started, and they had found 30,000 tablets in this library. Another one, they found 60,000 tablets in the library. These are very sophisticated, educated people. This is not some, you know, just strange band of, you know, of roving maniacs who don't know anything about the earth. These are people that really have a lot of capability. In fact, the wall, I think it was around Ur, the wall around Ur of the Chaldees, they've done some excavation there, and the wall was 70 feet thick. 70 feet thick and 80 feet tall, and went all the way around this city. And this is back in 2000 BC. We're not talking about people of low intelligence. We're talking about people of enormous intelligence. In fact, there's a lot of people that claim that there was intellect that dwarfed some of the thinkers even in the modern day. That's probably not true. The fact is, man hasn't changed much, and there's, you know, in the midst of all of his intellect and capability, there's still the problem of inability to see the facts. And what are the facts? The facts are there's a God. There's a creator God. And at that time, amongst all the intellectualism, people were worshiping whatever gods, the God of their choice. And they would, one of the biggest, the most widespread forms of deity was fertility. Fertility rites, kind of for obvious reasons, both the, you know, for people who just, you know, worship whatever they wanted to worship, really, is what it boiled down to. And it led nations to become just completely degraded in their behaviors and what they were doing, and it was, you know, there's really nasty stuff going on. Well, Abraham's chosen in the midst of that, and the fact that he would build an altar to the one true God, to God the Creator, the God of his ancestors, was something that God was pleased with. In the midst of the chaos, here's someone who's saying, God, I'm acknowledging you. I think that we need to remember that. We need to remember God's willingness to reach out in the midst of the chaos. As our nation is declining in many, many ways, certainly in many more ways. We are a democracy. That means ruled by the majority. As majority continue to have values that differ from our values, from Christian values, we're not going to have a whole lot of choice but to accept some of the things that happen. I'm not saying accept it nicely, and I'm not saying don't vote for alternatives. I vote for alternatives all the time. And if you feel like write your congressman or do whatever, fine, do it. I mean, as a citizen, that's our right, that's our privilege. But the fact is, we're not going to stop the freight train. The train is going to continue to go. And maybe we can slow it down a little bit with some of the action that that some of the those in the Christian community have been willing to put in. I'm not sure about that. I don't really know what impact we as believers can have. But one thing I do know, and that is that as long as we're a democracy, the majority is not going to share our values, and therefore we better be ready. Keep our seatbelts fastened, and watch things decline. God has been able, in the midst of chaos throughout the centuries, to protect His people, to hold His people, to bless His people. He has been able to do it. He has been willing to do it. He did it to Abraham, and Abraham's family is probably about 1,000 people by the time we get along here. I mean, it's a pretty good-sized group of kind of living somewhat of a Bedouin lifestyle, but God was willing to take care of them. He's willing to take care of us today. We worry about our children. A lot of us do, and for good reason. Our children, it's hard for our children to come through our society today unscathed. It's very difficult. But God is faithful. God is faithful to His people. And so we go along, and we can go without despair. We may have a little fear. We may have a little worry. Lord knows I certainly have had my share of worry with my children. But they can come out. They can come out the other side. God is going to be faithful. Well, we see it's interesting because we're going to see Abraham taking some things in his own hands even here. Here we have, and we've just described him as this great really beacon of faith in the midst of that land. And yet, there's another side. We're kind of talking about the good, bad. I was thinking about this. And if I had to make a title, you know, a placard outside, which I have no intention of doing, by the way, this would kind of be the good, bad, and the pretty, and we'll see why. Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. Okay, now you got to remember, you got to know something. At that time, it was a kind of a feudal system, more or less. Egypt was a little more centralized, but even there, it might makes right. I mean, the people that were powerful were the ones who kind of called the shots. And in Egypt, if you're powerful, if you're the Pharaoh, then you call the shots. And if there was a beautiful woman in the land, she's coming into your harem. That's the way it is. That was kind of the rule of the land. Well, that's not very good. Not a good thing. But Abraham knows this, and here's what he decides to do. It says, when he came near to Egypt, he said to Sarah, his wife, "Now see now, I know that you are a beautiful woman." That's nice. "It will come about when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they'll let you live. Please say that you are my sister, so it may go well with me because of you, and I may live on account of you." All right, well, that's a rather desperate measure here. I mean, we think, he didn't seem to think anything of it, which is a little strange, but that's just the way it is. So, they go down there, and indeed they say that, and what happens? Well, Sarah goes into the harem. She's in the harem. Abraham lives. Now, you can let your imagination move a little bit. I mean, in kind of normal conservative Christianity, we usually would try to say, oh, well, you know, she probably was just on the outskirts of it, you know. Nothing happened. Well, that's probably not true. First of all, and it certainly isn't realistic. But what happens is interesting. They came into Egypt. The Egyptians saw she was beautiful. Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And therefore, listen to this, he treated Abraham well for her sake and gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants. Female donkeys and cattle, or camels, excuse me. He got rich. Now, he already had, apparently, some means, but now he's got a lot. Now, that's quite a price to pay, and there's things that we call that kind of profession. But the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abram's wife. So she comes clean, and she lets him know what's happening. That's Pharaoh now. Pharaoh called Abram and he said, "Well, what is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister? So I took her for my wife. Now then, here's your wife. Take her and go." And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they escorted him away and his wife and all that belongs to him. They didn't even take the goods back. So what happens? Well, you know, Pharaoh has made Abram a very wealthy man, and he's gone. So he goes down there. There's a famine. He goes down and by this subterfuge gets rich, leaves, and goes back out. Now we would not today say that is a great example of faith. That's a little tough to say, right? Well. Abraham apparently did not, we would call it today, integrate well. You know? He didn't integrate his faith well. He didn't act on his faith very well, at least in this detailed thing. Did God punish him? Well, nothing is recorded of any kind of punishment. I hate to say it, but it worked for him. He got rich. Now, I don't know what the nature of their relationship really was. You know, I don't know whether she was upset with him. I hope she was, you know. I have to say one thing that is a little bit strange about our culture is that we've made such a huge deal about the whole issue of sexuality. We've made it into such an enormous, enormous centerpiece of life that we've kind of made these kind of events so shocking, so unthinkable, that it's hard for us to deal with this as Christians. In reality, I remember the first time that when I was in college, the first time I read the book of Genesis, I'd never read it before. I'd heard the stories as a kid, you know, I saw the flannel graphs and all this kind of stuff. But some of you don't even know what those are, you know. But I'd never read it, and so I had an assignment in a class. It was a, you know, this is UCSD. I mean, this secular school, godless school, really. One of the classes we had to take was a philosophy class, and they wanted to talk about the Bible as literature and philosophy. And so I had to read it. So I started reading, sat down, started reading the book of Genesis. And I couldn't put it down. I could not put it down. I sat and I read through the entire, I'm a slow reader, and this is King James, right? And I read through the entire book of Genesis and the entire book of Exodus in one sitting, just fascinated by it. And one thing it did is it showed me kind of a different view. I mean, I was, 18 years old at the time, and that's, at 18, there's a lot of things going through your mind. Well, there's usually one thing going through your mind. But the one thing about the book of Genesis is so matter of fact. And the whole issue of human sexuality, human events, of what it does, I realize that we as a country, we as a people, make such a huge deal out of certain things and what it does, especially the issue of human sexuality. We make such a huge deal out of it that it works against us in both ways. It becomes such a taboo, and I'm not advocating that it not be a taboo. Don't get me wrong. This takes much longer discussion than a few words, but let me just say, we have made it such an enormous taboo that it becomes incredibly attractive to everybody. We enhance the mystique of the whole thing because it's such a dualistic thing in our society. It is, on the one hand, we try to espouse values. On the other hand, every single thing we sell, every single thing that we air on the television, everything we do is somehow trying to activate that part of the human mind, that part of the human psyche. The things, the swimming apparel and clothes in general are just, in our society, in Western society in general, are designed to be just enough to remind you of everything about human sexuality without revealing just the last couple inches. It's incredible what we do. And that has made us, that just polarizes our community, polarizes us as a nation. The kind of crimes and all that we have in our society are really bizarre compared to other societies. It's really, really, very interesting. Well, the fact is, okay, this is a little shocking. And yeah, it should be shocking. And it's wrong. Yeah, definitely wrong. He shouldn't have done this. But he did it. Did God kick him out of heaven? No. Did it ruin his relationship with God? No, it didn't. Well, is that teaching us a lesson that it's okay to go and delve into evil because you just might get something out of it? No. No, that's not the intent. The fact is, God's faithfulness is not dependent on our actions, and that's what's really important. If there's nothing else that we learn, and in fact in Galatians chapter 3, Paul talks about this whole issue. He doesn't get into the details of Pharaoh and Sarah going into the harem of Pharaoh. But he does talk about the implications of the faith of Abraham. And they're really important to us today. In chapter 3, he says, you foolish Galatians, the people of Galatia, he says, you foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified? In other words, you know about the crucifixion of Christ. He says, this is the only thing I want to find out from you. Did you receive the Spirit by the works of the law, or by the hearing of faith? Are you so foolish? Having begun by the Spirit, are you now perfected by the flesh? Now, what's he getting at here? The people in Galatia had done what most Christian groups end up doing. And that is, they started on the foundation of the forgiveness from God through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ that all of us enjoy. The forgiveness of God. We have been granted access to the person of God through Jesus Christ. And when we were given that access to God, it wasn't because we were all doing a bunch of saintly things. Right? I mean, we weren't... When God chose every one of us in this room, it was in the midst of lifestyle, life conditions, life choices that probably weren't too good. In fact, we're probably pretty bad. I doubt that there are very many of us in this room whom God chose because we were just walking so righteously in our lives. I'm using that in a common sense, not the New Testament sense. So piously, so perfectly in our lives that we were making all these great choices and finally we found God along the way. You know, I don't think that happened. It doesn't happen very often, if at all. God picked us up. And when Jesus died for us, and when I'm saying us, I'm talking mankind. When Jesus died for mankind, it wasn't because mankind was treating him good. Mankind was not being responsive to him. His own people, the descendants of Abraham themselves, were not honoring Jesus, the Son of God. But he died anyway. And said he died willingly. And said that he was dying to provide the ultimate sacrifice through which God would be willing to grant forgiveness to mankind. I don't understand that, but that's the way it is. So what does this mean? The Galatians also came to know Jesus Christ. They came to know the forgiveness of Christ. And what did they start doing? They started setting up some sort of denomination, and they started setting up the rules. Here's the rules. If you really want to be a good Christian, here's what you got to do. They call them the Judaizers. They would take, they'd smuggle in pieces of the Jewish law, the Jewish tradition, and articulate it even more clearly, and they'd add to it all kinds of stuff, the same kind of stuff we've been doing for a long time as Christians. And Paul chides them for that. He says, "You're foolish. Look, faith is not the same as doing nice things. Doing good works. Faith is not that." And on the other side of things, doing bad things does not disqualify a person from the love of Christ. If there's nothing else that we remember in our lives, if there's nothing else that we teach our children, it needs to be that God's love for us is without condition. That faith is following God. Faith is not doing that flawlessly. We don't live flawlessly. We make a bunch of dumb mistakes. As Christians, we make mistakes. As Christians, we get caught up in habits and the consequences of poor decisions. We get caught up in ambition, in jealousies, in lust, and all kinds of things. We Christians are just human beings, and we do this stuff. We get afraid, and we make dumb things, or we'll lie because we don't really just don't think it through well enough. And we do so many things that could easily become reasons for us to say, "How can God like me anymore? How can He possibly care about?" One of the most encouraging moments that I've had was in the midst of it was just moments after probably the greatest heartache that I've had. And that was when our daughter came down and said to us that her life was empty. I remember her sitting there right at the kitchen counter. She was 19. And she said, "Mom and Dad, my life is empty. I need help." She said, "I've got a problem with drugs and alcohol." And you know, we knew there was some hurt in her life. We didn't know how bad it was. And the first question that I felt compelled to ask her was, "Well, what do you think God thinks of you?" And her response to me was, "I think He still likes me." And I got to tell you, right then I knew it was going to be okay. And I told her that. It's going to be okay. We're going to get through this. Why? Because the moment we are separated from, in our own minds, from the love of God, is when we're in trouble. The biggest trouble. There's no greater trouble than that. Nothing is worse than that. What separates, what gives us the perception of being separated from God, if we don't understand the love of God, if we don't understand the love of God and understand what real faith is, real faith is recognizing God is so big and so loving, so there, that doesn't matter what I do, He's going to be there for me. Now, a lot of people don't want to say that because they say, "Oh, that gives you license. You can go out and do whatever you want and come back to God and, you know, He'll take care of things." Hey, try it. It's not very much fun. Not fun at all. And it hurts. Abraham's relationship to God was not dependent on Abraham's perfect behavior, his impeccable values, his impeccable morals. He didn't have impeccable morals. Pretty ugly scene. Right on the, isn't the same chapter where we have these magnificent promises? God is available to us at all times. He loves us. He's reaching out. Faith is accepting that. Just accepting that. Accepting the love of God that is there. And don't get me wrong, Abraham made some good choices here too. Some things that he did that would be pretty tough to do. And he did it. God said, "Go do this," and he did it. Integrating it into his life, well, he wasn't quite as skilled at that. Who is? We have a lot of advantages as Christians today, followers of Christ, because the Holy Spirit is there working inside of us all, every moment of the day. But even then, the presence of the Holy Spirit doesn't keep us from sin. We still sin. We still fail. Now, I'd like to say, hopefully God is teaching us to not fail so frequently. I'd like to believe that. I think that that's true to a certain extent. A lot of things we continue to fail with through our lives. The things He wants to teach us, of course, are to have a heart that's humble before Him. And sometimes that takes failure and a lot of practice at failure. He wants to teach us to love. And that usually means having to experience some things that enable us to understand what other people are going through. So, those two things. He also wants to teach us patience. How do you learn patience unless you have adversity? Kind of stands to reason that there's a lot of things going on. But God's love is unchanging. No matter what we experience in our lives, we must fight the temptation to think that God is not available to us. We must fight it. Whether it is through sin or whether it's through prosperity, anything that makes us feel that somehow we aren't in touch with God, just chase those thoughts from the mind. And in the midst of whatever circumstance you're in at that moment, you can raise your heart to God, ask Him for help. Doesn't matter what it is.